This is Up By Your Bootstraps, a State of Opportunity special from Michigan Radio. I'm Jennifer White. There's a distance between people with money and people in poverty, and that impacts the way we think, how we talk, and what we try to do about poverty. A lot of the stories about poverty, particularly those Up By Your Bootstraps stories, are basically myths. But of course, there are people who totally beat the odds, and it turns out if ever there was a bootstrapping story, it would be my parents, Henry and Bessie White. So we're in Southfield, Michigan, where my parents now live, and we're at their house.
Hey, Pumpkin, I didn't know you were going to be home.
What I wanted to talk to you all about is basically like the leap you all made economically, because you grew up in rural Georgia. Mom, you grew up in rural Mississippi.
Well, he left Georgia when he was 8. I left Mississippi when I was 8.
How would you describe your economic condition when you were children?
Poor. Very, very poor.
My family was sharecroppers, so that explains it all, I think.
My people were not sharecroppers. What I remember about Mississippi was part of the time my father was he was in World War II. He was a soldier. We had very little. And that my mother worked when she could, but she was in poor health. At one time, we were down to nothing but cornmeal in the house. And they would make like a cornmeal mush, you know. I just cried and said, I'm tired of this cornmeal mush. Mm-hmm. And she went to bed and she covered her head and she prayed. And when she woke up, the postman was there and he had brought her a check from my father. But it was rough. We would go across the street, there was a railroad track, and we would pick up coal to burn in the stove. Things were really bad.
Both your families came up, well, Dad, for you all, it was to follow the automotive jobs?
When I came up, like I said, I was about 8 years old. But from what I gathered over the years, she moved because I couldn't go to school because I had polio at 4 years old. And the schoolhouse was, quite a distance away. So the teacher refused to come and pick me up to take me to school. So she came to the conclusion that, the best place for us to go was to move to Detroit.
When you think about her decision to move here to make sure you had an education, how important do you think that decision was to your ability to, make a life for yourself?
Well, in retrospect, it's quite clear that was very vital, because if I had remained there, I would not have had any means of support except manual labor or whatever, picking cotton or whatever was available there. So by moving to Detroit, I was able to go to a special school because of my handicap, and paved the way for me to be able to go to Cass Tech, a technical school where there was training. I had the training of a draftsman, which kind of set my course. I didn't know at the time that would be, of any value, because drafting was not something that was open to blacks at that time. The drafting in the automobile industry was closed. Mm-hmm. And by the time that civil rights took place, it was just at the appropriate time that the door opened and I was able to go in, with the education that was provided.
And you were one of the first black drafters GM hired.
Yes.
As part of their affirmative action program?
Yes, one of three.
You all got married fairly young, I guess it's fair to say.
I was 20, he was 23.
And you and Dad had 7 kids.
Mm-hmm.
You stayed home with us for the most part. I just have this strong memory of certain things you all put a big focus on. Reading, the way we spoke, table manners, and
which you didn't cooperate all the time.
spending a lot of time at the library. Mm-hmm. You would, mm-hmm. On the summers, you would take us to the DIA and make sure we spent.
Yep.
What was that about for you?
Well, I was not an avid reader, but I knew that reading was very important. If you were going to be successful, I thought you needed to be able to read well. I had some bad experiences in my early, childhood. In Mississippi, I raised my hand to ask a question, and the teacher hit me in my nose and gave me a nosebleed. because I didn't understand something. So I didn't want that to happen to one of my children. So education was very important. I was out of school for a while because of that. My mother just refused to send me back. So then when we came here, I remember my favorite cousin took me to the library. It was the first time I had been to a library. And she picked out a book and she said, "Here, can you read this?" And I was stumbling over the words. I'll never forget that. I came to the conclusion then that my children would know how to read.
In a lot of ways, I think people would look at what you've done. You've raised 7 kids, you've put children through college, and people would look at you and say, well, that's what we mean when we say bootstrapping. But do you think you bootstrapped it?
No. No. The door was open. If I had not been exposed to Castech especially, that was the boot and the strap, if you will, in which you could actually do something with.
We had certain goals, you know, like to own a home was a biggie to me, where you could grow up, you didn't move from pillar to post.
You know, since we both came from dysfunctional homes, I mean, where there was, a lot of drinking and that was something that we did not desire for you all to be reared in that type of environment.
It wasn't that someone told you these are the things you need to do to raise your kids. It was more that you were trying to model the opposite of what you grew up in.
What we didn't have. What we didn't have.
Do you think today you could do the same thing you did? Do you think it's as easy to do that today, or do you think it's harder?
It wasn't easy then, believe me.
Mm-hmm.
I think people can do more than they think they can if they're willing to sacrifice. And it's about your priorities.
We know families who never made it out of poverty. Mm-hmm. You know, those we talk about generational poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And you all broke you broke that chain in your lives. And what I'm wondering is if you think for people who are still in that cycle, with the economic climate and everything as it is now, do you think they have the same ability to move forward?
It just seems like there's so much emphasis on what you have, you know, what kind of phone you have, what you wear.
It's hard to answer because of the change in the culture. You know, there's a culture change, like Mom was saying. There's so much emphasis placed on some things that are not important. It seems as though that society and those who are a part of it, they want the American dream, but the means are not there now. Even those that are have gone through college, they are having a struggle. Back then, if you went to college, you had opportunities were bright, and you know, that's not so now.
Those were my parents, Henry and Bessie White. They have that grit, that something that makes some people more resilient. Listening to my parents' story, you might think that the reason they were successful was because they pulled themselves up by their bootstraps. But as you heard, even they don't think that. In actuality, a lot of things lined up for them: education, civil rights, and what some people would call lucky breaks. But so often, when we look at people living in poverty today, we think that it's a choice, that they just have different values. Remember that comment we heard earlier? You don't have a diploma. Well, get one.
So, yeah, the idea is wrong in a number of ways.
That's Professor Mario Small, a Harvard University sociologist. He studies poverty and culture, and he says this culture of poverty idea, which came about in the 1960s, it's just too simple.
And by the way, I should say that in the American context, this idea is typically used to describe low-income, often inner-city African-Americans. that. And the idea is something like they tend to believe different kinds of things, tend to, for example, value education a lot less than others. And it is for this reason that many people have difficulty escaping poverty. And the, what's wrong with this idea is that it's actually not very well supported by the evidence. If you ask African-American teenagers and white teenagers how much they value education, they're going to give you the same kinds of answers. How much they think work is important in order to do well in life, they're going to give you the same kinds of answers. How much they think they need to work on their own as opposed to depend on the state in order to do well, they're going to give you the same kinds of answers.
So has this term, culture of poverty, become code for something else?
That's a great question. So yeah, for many people, the idea of culture of poverty is basically just saying, look, it's black people's own fault, especially low-income black people's own fault that they're in consistent poverty.
It's a way of explaining the difference we feel between ourselves and people who are living in poverty. So it's almost a reflection maybe more on the middle class.
I think in many respects that's actually true. I think there's quite a bit of truth to that. The fact of the matter is that a simple version of a culture explanation that says it's all people's values, it's a very easy explanation for complex problems. The sociologists who believe that culture plays a role in people's behavior, and I'm one of them, would tell you that we know in many kinds of contexts that culture plays a role. It's a very different conception of culture, which is a conception that was proposed by a French sociologist, Pierre Bourdieu, called cultural capital.
Does that idea of cultural capital also impact the way we view parenting? I don't know if you're familiar with the free-range parenting movement about giving children more independence. Mm-hmm. And so this is really coming out of the middle class, and it's praised when, you know, among certain circles that, you know, give kids independence, let them explore their surroundings and become more accustomed to making decisions on their own. Yet low-income parents are often criticized for not parenting enough.
Letting their kids run wild,
right? Yeah, yeah.
I think that's a perfect example of what we were talking about earlier. You know, when a middle-class parent says, well, I've got to cultivate my kid and I've got to put him into all of these activities and so on, and then there's a backlash among the middle class, and then you see all these articles in the New York Times or New Yorker or whatever it is, they say, well, now we have to, no, we're over-parenting. We have to let the kids roam and sort of discover themselves and learn tough lessons and fall back and realize that failure is fine and that they'll survive and so on. In truth is, the middle-class parents can shift their cultural practices up and down for quite a while with a lot of room for error because they have the economic resources for their kids. Their kids are going to college no matter what they do, right? Whereas in the low-income communities, it's very easy to pick a difference that's cultural and then call it the cause for the difference.
We have an issue in the legislature here in Michigan right now. It's already a practice, but they want to set it into law that welfare benefits to families can be cut off if a child is truant from school.
That's a classic example. The punitive approach to addressing poverty is an approach that very quickly and very easily calls on the idea of culture as people's values because it's an easy thing to blame.
Now, you're one of the researchers who has moved away from this idea of there being an inherent culture of poverty. But it takes time for policy and popular belief to catch up with complexities and research. So what happens in that gap?
I think that's a great question. This is part of the reason I think it's important for those of us who are doing this kind of work to talk to people at large. I mean, there's two aspects of this. One of this has to do with actual policy, and then the other one has to do with sort of the national conversation, which is not strictly policy. It's just how people are thinking about problems. What you were talking about earlier about sort of middle-class people's assumptions about their parenting is a great example. We all naturally tend to attribute our success to our own actions, right? Every student who gets into college will tell you they got in because of all of the hard work they put in. You know, every parent whose child is successful will tell you it was because of their effective, not every, but many, their effective parenting. And the truth is our own actions play a big role. They're important. They're necessary. But all of our actions occur within a system of resources and institutional and economic supports.
So what is a useful framework, perhaps a simple framework to use when we want to talk about poverty and the forces that are in place that can create this cycle that we see families locked into?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I've racked my brain about this because, you know, as a scholar, what I see is, you know, four decades of research after the culture of poverty idea and a lot of data and a lot of resources. But then as a public commentator, you can't ask people to go and read 15 books on this one question. I think at the risk, I am going to oversimplify, and all my colleagues will have to, you know, forgive me for this. But one easy route would be to think, you know, ask yourself what happens if you think instead of cultural values about cultural knowledge. Not knowing something is certainly nobody's fault. And cultural knowledge is a big part of the reason many people do well for those things that can be affected by culture. So cultural knowledge is a big part of the reason why many of the kids who say they want to go to college don't apply to college, don't fill out the FAFSA, don't even write the essay, take the PSAT. A lot of that is just cultural knowledge, knowing that you have to do those things, knowing that that is the process. I think that's the one thing I would say.
That was sociologist Mario Small. Even if the idea of a culture of poverty is a myth, people can feel conflicted about moving up the economic ladder. It can sometimes mean leaving people or places behind.
So my name is David Nguyen. I am 22 as of 2 days ago. I'm a senior majoring in cell molecular biology. Even though this is only 45 minutes away, this is particularly very far from what I'm used to. Mom and dad didn't go to college. My family lived in government-funded housing, and even though financial stability was missing in my upbringing, there was always family to compensate for that. The community I consider myself being part of back home is the Vietnamese Roman Catholic community. The youths in my community, which have a similar upbringing to me, where their parents are immigrants, they're first generation. So I see myself in these adolescents. I felt that there was this distance that was growing every single time I was coming back, this lost connection as I progressed through my academic career. And not being able to be that mentor, it's quite saddening and disappointing to me. I wouldn't want to raise my children in the community. With the opportunities I had, I would define those as far from ideal for a world I view as very competitive.
Coming up, this distance between people who have lots of resources and those who don't isn't just about how we feel. It evolves into the policies we create, and that affects us all. This is Up By Your Bootstraps, a State of Opportunity special from Michigan Radio. You can continue to share your thoughts with us on Facebook. Just search for State of Opportunity or tweet us at State of Op with two P's. And if you have a story you think can help our State of Opportunity reporting, be a resource for this project by going to stateofopportunity.michiganradio.org. Click on the Share Your Story link.